Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Alarmy. Before we get started, we wanted to make sure you heard the big news. The Alarmist has joined Patreon. Patreon subscribers will get access to our content ad-free, as well as our Aftermath post-interview discussion and final verdict. We'll also be putting out additional bonus episodes and other fun stuff. Here's a preview of Guest Alarmist, where I step aside and let a guest walk us through a personal tragedy, and together the Alarmist crew figures out who's to blame. This month, Alex Paul discusses the Beverly Hills hotel heist.
The promise of a free vacation.
That's good.
I mean, like that.
Nothing in this world is free.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nothing in this world is free. And that's what kind of made us dig deeper, is like, we had no money. We were broke. This seemed like a little fun opportunity and we could not let it go. Mm-hmm. We wanted it to happen. We couldn't just be like, no, we're not, Peter, we're not on the reservation, goodbye, turn around. We were like, no, like, this is our one little freebie fun thing, like, we should have it.
We want, you know, like, it's like maximizing, like, on sales, you know, when there's an offer, you can't let it go.
Yes,
you can't let it go.
I know I can't let it go, and apparently Alex also
can't let it go so easily. I love letting offers go. I love when offers come along and I'm just like, nope.
Not going to take it.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now, on to our episode. Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today we're speaking with guest expert Joe Turner. Joe is a true crime writer and author of The Boy in the Walls, the bizarre story of Daniel LaPlante. Let's hear what he has to say about the case of Daniel LaPlante. Hi Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem, thank you for having me, I appreciate it.
So first off, I wanted to ask you, what is frogging? When did the term come about? And can you give us some history on this act?
Well, it's quite a modern phenomenon, I believe. Well, it's a modern term anyway. It's only been conjured in the past few years. The history of it is, it's not very well documented, I'm afraid, because there haven't been many cases of this happening at all, really, in human history. It's very rare. So there's the trace about the history of it is quite difficult. But basically means someone hiding in your residence without your awareness, you know, and that can extend from, you know, homeless people trying to find shelter or, as I'm sure we'll delve into in a minute, you know, more sinister intentions from some of the hiders.
Yes. And how does it differentiate from squatting?
Well, see, I've never really looked into that. I mean, it's kind of, I think what frogging is a little more, there's an element of sort of sinister intentions with frogging, whereas with squatting, it's kind of, you know, if they get caught, they happily say, look, I'm looking for somewhere to stay, because usually squatters are usually homeless people looking for somewhere to, you know, to shelter. Whereas frogging has a little bit more, there's another different element, a more sinister overtone to frogging.
Now, in our episode, we focused on the crimes committed by Daniel LaPlante.
Yes.
Can you start by giving us some backstory on Daniel, where he's from, what his childhood was like, and what was his family life like?
Absolutely. Well, Daniel LaPlante was born in 1970 in a place called Townsend, Massachusetts, a very small rural area of New England. Growing up, Daniel's life was it was very chaotic. It was sort of like it was kind of the perfect storm of circumstances for a deviant to thrive, really. I mean, Daniel was the third of four children, and growing up, he was, well, it's all started before he was even born, because he was the product of an affair. Like, he wasn't his air quotes biological father's son. And right away from that moment, his life was sort of sent into turmoil. He was abused from a young age, right from the age of about two to five, by his real biological father, because his biological father discovered that he was the product of an affair. And from that point on, it just kind of got worse for Dan. I mean, he wasn't the smartest kid in the world, so he struggled at school, he struggled academically. He surrounded himself with people that kind of aided his thirst for chaos, really. Like, he was he hung around with other delinquents, and by the age of 12, 13, he was burgling houses, starting fires, you know, hurting animals, trampling on vegetable patches, causing all sorts of trouble. And then it progressively got worse from there. So that was his childhood in a nutshell. It was a classic, cliched, you know, troubled childhood, really. You couldn't make up the stuff that he went through.
Who is Tina Bowen, and how and when does she come into contact with Daniel?
Tina Bowen was the object of Dan's affection, basically. It all started when Dan was 16, 1986 this was. Tina was 15 years old. They met at an open school event. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those. I think they're an antiquated thing now. They met at an open school event. Well, actually, I should go a little bit further back than that. Tina, she was the typical teenage girl in the 80s, you know, Madonna, hoop earrings, big hair, that kind of thing. And of course, like a lot of other teenagers, she was boy obsessed. She used to give out her number to a lot of the boys she liked in town. And then one day she gets a call from someone she doesn't know. And on the other end of the phone is this boy saying he's a young jock, athletic, blonde, blue-eyed, you know, stud. Tina believes him. Tina takes his word for it. And then they chat for, you know, a couple of months, I believe it was. And then one day Tina was at this open school event that I mentioned. And she gets a knock on her shoulder, turns around, and there's a boy there, and the boy's disheveled, greasy hair, black leather jacket. And she said, and the boy says, "I'm Danny. I'm the boy that you've been talking to on the phone for the past few months." And now, of course, Tina's, you know, she can't quite process it, because the person on the phone she believed was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed looker, and Danny was the polar opposite. So Tina kind of humoured him. She entertained him. She gave him a chance, basically. Well, she kind of, I say, led him on, but she kind of felt sorry for him, because he didn't look the best, and she put some effort into this relationship, air quotes, she had with him. So they went out on a few dates. It didn't go anywhere, and then after the second date, Tina shut the door on him. Never saw him again, and that's Tina's backstory. Yeah,
when does Tina start noticing strange occurrences inside her home? What kind of things was she experiencing?
Her strange experiences began in, it was early 1986. It was around March 1986. And it began somewhat innocently because Tina had two sisters. She had one biological sister named Karen, one adopted sister named Kathy. Now, Karen was 9 at the time. Kathy was 16. So there were 3 girls in this house. They didn't have a mother because she passed away the same year from cancer, sadly. Had a father, however, he was always at work because he had to provide for these 3 girls. So these 3 girls were the main occupants of their home. And started innocently enough, there were little things going missing, and these little things each girl attributed to one of the other girls. Like if something went missing out of the cupboards, Tina would just assume it was Karen or Kathy. If an alcohol bottle, got a little, if someone drank out of that, Kathy would assume it was Tina or Karen. It's stuff that you overlook when provided it happens in small doses. And then over time, between March and late 1986, things got progressively worse. There would be knocks against the wall. There would be mess left out on the tables. There would be little periods of music blaring without explanation. TV channels would come on. And when I say that, it sounds like a cliched haunting, but that's really what happened. I've spoken to these girls at length for years now, and they've told me it's absolutely true. TV channels would change, TV would come on, the volume would go up, and it was all like little brief flashes of, there's no way to explain it. They assumed it was they were being haunted because it was the youthful naivety of teenagers. They assumed it was their mother's ghost trying to contact them. And then over time there were more sinister, connotations over time. There was an incident where Tina woke up one morning covered in crumbs from a sandwich that had been left out on a table the night before. Oof. There was one incident where all the girls woke up and they got into a blazing argument because someone had left their mother's wedding dress out on the bed. That someone had just posed it on the bed, and they all thought it was one of the others playing a trick on them. So, and obviously none of them owned up to it. And then it got to the point where Kathy, who was the oldest girl, the non-biological sister, she needed to go to therapy because she was convinced that she was going insane. And their father, Frank, of course, all he saw was the aftermath. So he didn't really know. He never saw these things happening in real time. He never saw a TV channel jump up and change and whatever. When he got home at 11 p.m. midnight, he just saw the mess that had been created. And he assumed it was his daughter's playing this mess. And of course, they all denied it. So he said, look, you girls, there's something wrong. He assumed it was the trauma of losing their mother. He said, look, you need to go to therapy, you need counseling, you need to see someone because this is not healthy. And then it carried on like that for there was about 8 months of it in total before the inevitable discovery of the truth, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute.
Can you tell us more about this discovery? How does it all come to a head?
Well, there were two incidents which really stand out. It was December the 8th, 1986. The girls got home because the Tina and Kathy, the two older girls, they worked at a local horse farm, and they got home after work one night. And their house was in a complete state. It was a complete disarray. It was like the worst kind of, imagine a poltergeist playing havoc with your house. That's what they come back to. And there was a message on the wall saying, come and find me, I'm in your room. There was a message written in shaving foam on the wall that said, I'm going to kill you. There was a picture of the Bowen family on the wall with a knife stuck through Tina's face. And the girls got home to this. And then they called their dad. The dad came home as well. And again, the dad thought that they were just messing around. He thought they were just bored girls and they were messing with him. So the dad kind of kicked off and he started looking around the house. And Tina and Kathy were like, this is not us. Someone else is doing this to us. Someone else lives in our house. And then Frank, the father, starts rampaging through the house saying, oh, whoever is this, I'm going to find them. And then he pulled open a closet door. And to his shock, there was a young boy in there. And this young boy was dressed in a massive coat. He had face paint on and he had his hair smoked up in a mohawk. And Frank, he can't really explain this, but he kind of had a moment of, like, he was so shocked he couldn't really process what he was seeing. Mm. And then he yelled to Tina and he said, I found him. I found the intruder. And the way he worded it suggested that Tina knew that this person was hiding in the closet, you know? And he imagined, Frank thought it was all this big conspiracy. And then the person in the closet comes out. He's got a wrench in one hand. And then Frank suddenly realizes, no, this is not someone who my daughter knows. This is a stranger in my house. And then, of course, the stranger, he orders the whole family to get in the upstairs bedroom. He threatens them with this wrench. He says, you'll get in the bedroom now. So there's Frank, Tina, Kathy, Karen, all in hysterics because they've just opened the place that they look at every day and there's someone hiding there. He tells them all to get into the little bedroom upstairs. They do. They barricade the door shut. And then all they can hear from outside is this stranger burgling their house. They hear him going around the house, just picking things up. And to this day, they don't really know what he was doing there, but they can only assume he was, you know, robbing things. Sorry, robbing is a colloquial British term for stealing. So sorry if that doesn't translate. I was trying to hold back my Britishness.
You're doing great.
Thank you. And then, so the Bowen family are barricaded in this room upstairs. Tina, for all her heroism, opens the window, climbs outside, jumps out in the back garden, runs to the next door neighbor's house, calls the police. She says to the neighbor, she says, someone's in my house, someone we don't know. Because at this point, Tina didn't know who it was, didn't recognize him. Someone's in our house. Called the police. The police came around within an hour or so. And by this point, the police had become so sick of the Bowen family calling them because every time something would go wrong, they would call the police and say, look, someone's in our house. The police never believe them. You know, it's a perfect example of real life, the boy who cried wolf. They were like, nothing is in this house. It's just girls messing with us. So this time the police came around and Frank corroborated their claims. He said, yes, there was someone in our house and he barricaded us. He was trying to either burgle us or kill us. So the police searched this house and they found nothing. They found no trace of anyone. They found no one hiding in any of the walls, in any of the closets, anywhere, any of the cool spaces, nothing. And so the police were getting very tired at this point because they were like, what the hell is going on here? So they left it. Now, at this point, the Bowen family were so terrified to stay in their house, they disappeared for a few days. Mm. They went to the neighbouring town of Fitchburg, stayed there for 2 days. Then they came back 2 days later, December the 10th, 1986. But this time, it was the evening. And when they came back, Frank, the father, saw a light on in the upstairs bedroom.
Oof.
And then he saw a silhouette at the window. He said, is that someone in my house and shouldn't be in my house? So rather than go inside, he said to the girls, we stay back, we call the police, we get them to storm inside and find whoever this is. So they did, they called the police. And boy who cried wolf again, the police arrived. Frank said, look, I just saw someone in there at my window. No one should be in there. We deserted this place 2 days ago. Police went in, searched everything they could, searched all the usual spaces, all the bedrooms, everything, and they found nothing. Then one of the officers, a guy named Steve, really great guy, he went down in the basement. Mm. And Steve, I've talked to him a million times, and he can't explain this. He said, I just knew that someone was in that basement because he's like an experienced hunter. He's got sort of, he reckons he's got tracking skills, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, I know someone is in this basement. So Steve pulled this basement to bits. He checked every single nook and cranny, right? And there was this one section of the basement with, it's hard to picture, but if you imagine the corner of a room, then imagine a plank of wood placed against the corner so it makes like a triangle shape at the back. Uh-huh. And it's, yeah, it's, and in front of this board, there was a washing machine and a toilet, and the board hid all the piping equipment to the back, all the plumbing equipment. Steve saw that and thought, I think someone could get into that space. So Steve, he grabs this board, he pulls it slightly away from the wall, and there's a gap of about 7 inches, he said. And then he put his hand into this gap of 7 inches. He felt around and he felt a pile of clothes. Dig deeper. Grabbed another hand. He pulled up. And then he realized he had hold of an arm, a human arm. Pulled it out. Steve was like, someone in here. Someone's hiding in this section behind all the washing machine and the plumbing equipment. Yanked him out. Boom. There he was, the intruder.
Wow.
Hiding behind this very tiny gap, sort of like a tiny fridge, basically, a refrigerator that can only be accessed by a gap of around 7 inches, which the police officer that arrested him, I spoke to him 100 times, he says he can't believe anyone, even a child, could get into this tiny space. However, they pulled him out. There was Daniel LaPlante, and the truth quickly surfaced. He'd been hiding in this house for about 8 months or so, tormenting the girls from afar.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And no one was looking for Daniel during this time, and none of his family was out looking for him?
Well, a perfect storm of circumstances there, because Tina assumed that Danny didn't want to know her either, because she dumped him. She assumed he wasn't interested. And they lived around 8 miles apart, Tina and Danny. So it wasn't like she would run into him, you know, around town. They went to different schools, they hung in different circles. So it wasn't like they would run into each other around town. Danny's parents, that was a different story, because they either half the time they didn't care where he was, and a lot of the times he didn't stay overnight in the house. He would get to the house just after Frank left for work in the evening, then he'd stay there until around 11 p.m. and then he'd sneak out the back and he'd go home. So he was never really out overnight. In any occasions where he did stay there overnight, he told his mom and stepdad that he was staying at his friend Al's house. So he always had like a cover, you know? So he really covered himself. And when he took them hostage, he was covered in face paint and he couldn't recognize him, basically. And at this point, Tina hadn't seen him for 8 months, so she didn't recognize him at all. And Frank and the other girls had never seen him before in any detail, so they didn't recognize him.
I see.
So he had a lot of fortune in his favor, really.
Yes, and I'm struck by how online and in things we've read, it says he threatened them with a hatchet, but I believe it is now a wrench, correct?
It was a wrench, yeah. It wasn't a hatchet, yeah. There's so many small details about this that's just kind of, that's been, you know, morphed into myth. There's loads of little seeds of ideas that have transcended what really happened and become urban legends, really. And it's quite fascinating how that's happened. Like I mentioned, mentioned the wedding dress earlier. Dan at one point took out Tina's mother's wedding dress and laid it on the bed. And then there are some sources that say when he was found in the walls, he was wearing the wedding dress, which he wasn't.
Right.
But that idea came from the seed. And there's like a million different things like that.
Now, once he's taken into custody, he's later released on bail. I'm assuming he was considered a low risk. Why was he released?
He was in juvenile detention for 10 months. So okay. from December 86 to October 87, he was in juvenile. And it wasn't until his mother posted bail, $10,000, that he was able to get out. So he should have been in there a lot longer, but his mother got him out.
I see.
Yeah.
After he's released on bail, it seems like he goes right back to his previous behavior. And sadly, this time he commits murder. Can you discuss the crimes that happen and how they lead to this triple homicide?
Right. So he was released on bail in October 1987. And almost immediately, he was back to his life of delinquency. He was burgling houses by late October, November. Straight back to his old life. He didn't learn anything in juvenile at all. And there was one house that he focused on intently, and that was the home of Andrew and Priscilla Gustafson, who lived around a mile away from Dan, and his house was connected to theirs by a stretch of woods. Like Dan's house backed onto the woods. You go a mile through there, you get straight to the Gustafson house. Not sure why he was so obsessed with this home, but the one theory I had is that back in the 70s, there was a famous murder that happened right next to the Gustafson home. And you can kind of see the house from where they were. And that's one of my personal theories as to why Dan focused on this house so much. But anyway, the home belonged to Priscilla, Andrew Gustafson, and their children, William and Abigail, who were 8 and 5. Now, Dan burgled this home multiple times. He was in and out between October and December 87. But then on December 2nd, 87, he broke into this house sometime in the early afternoon. He waited in there, and then at around 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon, Priscilla returns home with her son, William. Dan, for reasons which we're still discussing today, who we don't quite know why, he came prepared with a pistol that he'd stolen from his stepfather and a lot of bullets that he'd stolen from his neighbour. Mm-hmm. He takes Priscilla and William hostage, gets Priscilla into the bedroom. He ties her up, he binds her, he restrains her, he gags her, and then he leaves her on the bed. Meanwhile, he takes William, takes him to the upstairs bathroom, puts him in the bathtub, fills it with an inch of water, puts his foot on the back of his head, and drowns William in his bathtub. Now, meanwhile, Priscilla is still alive in the bedroom. Danny goes in there. For some reason, we don't know why, Danny did a lot of weird things which didn't really help add anything to his crimes, just little odd tokens of which we'll talk about in a minute. He puts a gun inside a pillowcase, and then he shoots Priscilla through it.
Wow.
Maybe it was an attempt to silence it. I don't know why. And then just as Dan is leaving the house, he's walking out. And this is one of the most tragic things about this case, is that just as Dan was leaving, like literally seconds crossed, then Abigail, the other child, 12-year-old Abigail, comes home, sees Dan at the door. Dan realizes he can't let this young girl go. Like, he knows that it's Priscilla's daughter. He says he can't let this girl go. She has to die as well. So he takes Abigail, takes to the downstairs bathroom, does the same again, puts her in an inch of water, pumps on her head, drowns her, dead. Oh, three members of this family, triple homicide. Now, why Dan didn't shoot them, I'm not sure. But however, Dan, it's sometimes important to mention that he was obsessed with Nazi torture experiments. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those. And one of his most preferred ones was the submerging people in water. So I think that's where he got the idea from.
Wow.
So he did that, yeah. Horrible. That's a little nugget that's never been mentioned anywhere.
Yeah.
So I would add that. Yeah.
Now, how was Daniel then caught by the authorities this time?
Well, this is quite... It's good because the police officer that arrested Dan when they found him in the walls of the Bowen home, he immediately suspected that Dan would be responsible for this. I mean, it was a massive escalation from stalking to triple homicide. But the Tom thought, there's one guy that is capable of this and he lives a mile away. I think this is the escalation of Daniel's plans. So the local police, they go and they try and track Dan down. They don't have much luck. They find him at a library. They ask him about the murders and Dan denies everything. And then over the next 24 hours, there's some evidence discovered in the woods between the Gustafsson house and the Plant house. They discover there was a couple of hair samples. There was a shoe print. There was a hair fiber. There was a sock that they discovered. So, well, I should mention as well that at the Gustafsson scene, there was Daniel left a porno magazine behind for some reason. Still don't know why to this day. And he'd also filled two glasses of wine and left them on the kitchen table. And one of the reasons why Tom suspected Dan is because Dan did similar things at the Bowen scene. He would fill cups of alcohol and just leave them around. And no one really ever knew why. So that was like a little signature or ritual or whatever he left behind. So they immediately suspected Dan. And then once they had probable cause to investigate him because they found this evidence in the woods, they were straight to Dan's house. However, Dan foresaw them coming, ran out the back, ran out of his house and fled. And then by this point, only innocent people don't really tend to run. So pretty much everyone in town knew that Daniel LaPlante was responsible for this triple homicide. So what followed next was the largest manhunt in Massachusetts history, apparently. So they called in the state police. They even called in some FBI. And they said, we have to find this suspect, Daniel LaPlante. His face was on newspapers all over the state. And yeah, they said, we've got to find him. He said, he can't get far. He can't drive. He hasn't got a license. He hasn't got any money. So he can't, the only place he can really go is on foot. So we got to find this guy.
I'm assuming this is when they finally catch him on the run. He's carjacked someone's car.
Well, he tries his luck, really, at a bunch of houses because he's looking for a car. Dan thinks the best way to escape freedom is to look for a car. And his plan was to go to Fitchburg, where his sister lives, and stay with her. Now, of course, that's just an example of Dan's lack of understanding of the consequences of his crimes, really, you know? Like, he's traumatized. He thinks he can just hide out at his sister's house, like his sister's going to go, oh, yeah, coming in, just hide out here for a few days. I mean, Dan had never really faced consequences in his life, so this is a perfect, it's very much him. So he's trying to find a car. He goes through lots of houses in Townsend and Pepperell. Most people don't know who he is, so they tend to go away. However, he comes to the home of Pamela Makala. He breaks into the back of her house. He's looking for her car keys. He can't find them. However, Pamela comes home while Dan is in her kitchen, and she walks in and she sees Dan eating a sandwich at her table, just as if he was an old friend. And then Pam realizes who Dan is. She says, she was at work an hour before and she saw his face on the front of a newspaper. Then she gets home and there he's waiting in the kitchen. And he's got a knife in one hand. He's got a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the other. And then Pam doesn't quite know what to do. And I love Pam. She's a good friend of mine now. She told me her first thought was to find something hard and smash him over the head, but she couldn't find anything hard. So she had to go with her.
Wow.
Yeah. So Dan held her at, he had a gun as well at this point. He held the same gun that he killed the Gustafsons with, a gun and a knife. So he took Pam at gunpoint and he made her drive him where he wanted to go. So they got into her car, which was a massive orange van, which was very lucky that it was so visually striking because it comes in useful later. And then she got down in the car. She only managed to drive him down the road before she put the car in. What's your equivalent of neutral in America?
Neutral, I think.
Is it neutral?
Also neutral, yes.
I thought it was park or something, I don't know. Yeah. So they put it in neutral, then she jumps out the car. She gets like barely half a mile down the road, jumps out the car, runs like hell, leaves Dan in the car on his own. And then she sees her car speed off. So Dan has like hijacked the car in panic and he's going to where? However, Dan can't drive very well. He didn't have a license. So he was just trying to, you know, he was doing what he could. So he wasn't going to be able to go like on freeways or anything in the car because he didn't have a job. So, and then fortunately, Pam managed to track down a cruiser. And in the cruiser is Tom, the guy I mentioned earlier, the police officer that found Dan at the Bowen house and was the one who suspected that Gustafson murders would be committed by Dan. Finds Tom and she tells Tom the direction that Dan was headed. Tom calls in reinforcements, gets everyone in this direction. And they search this entire area. Mm. And their theory was that Dan was trying to go to a train station because that's the easiest way for him to flee. So they cancel all the trains in the area. And they searched nearby the nearest train station. And over the road, there was a lumber yard. And they had sniffer dogs. And the sniffer dogs were trying to pull them into the lumber yard. They said, right, someone in here, someone hiding in here. At the back of the lumberyard was this giant trash compactor, I guess. Big brown thing. They pull all the trash out and there hiding inside was Daniel LaPlante.
Wow.
Been on the run for about 2 days or so. And that's the end of his story.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I do want to quickly just ask you what he was eventually charged with and what he was sentenced.
Dan was only ever tried for the murders because he was also on at the time he was also he was going to be trialed for sexual assault because he'd committed several rapes in his youth. And he was going to be trialed for, I'm not sure what the exact charge was, but stalking and the home invasion charge, basically, for the bow and stuff. But he never got around to those crimes because he was charged of homicide. He was awarded 3 life sentences, and that kind of overwrote all his other charges. So he was only ever charged with multi-homicide, basically. And he was given 3 life sentences, 15 years per each victim, which was all he could be awarded with because he was 18 years old at the time.
Mm.
A sentence he's still serving to this day.
Wow. So, okay, finally, Joe, we ask all of our guest experts this question. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or a thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the crimes of Daniel LaPlante, who or what would that be?
Oh, man. Oh, sorry, I'm going to need to think about this one. I would blame the lack of support that he was given as a child. Like, it was obvious to see that Dan wasn't a normal kid. He had many problems that were obvious to even the layperson, and nobody really provided him any help. Like, one or two teachers tried, but he just kind of always slipped through the cracks. And there were multiple opportunities to catch him, put him behind bars, and no one ever did. And it ended with the the death of three innocent people. So I would say the lack of support and maybe the lack of care, you know? Maybe no one just cared to do anything about it, you know? Like it was society's problem, not their personal problem. And I think that's what led to the downfall of him and the tragic loss of three people.
Joe, thank you so much for speaking with us today and walking us through this very traumatizing and scary case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned because next week we will be discussing the Joan Crawford and Bette Davis feud. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.